HanselMinutes.com.
It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 173, recorded live Thursday, July 23rd, 2009. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Mary Jo Foley about Windows 7 and the future of Microsoft.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. I'm here today talking with Mary Jo Foley. Mary Jo runs the All About Microsoft blog for ZDNet. She has an unblinking eye on Microsoft, and you've been doing journalism around Microsoft for a very long time, haven't you, Mary Jo?
I have, Scott. Way too long.
are you sick of looking at just one company?
No. You guys are always a fascinating company, because every time you think you've figured out Microsoft and you've got it all figured out and you know what they're going to do, they do something surprising.
Yeah, that Project Natal sure surprised me. I didn't see that coming at all.
Yeah, really? Well, it's good they can still surprise people who work there.
Well, it's funny. I mean, we're 80,000 people, and something like Natal comes out, they go on Jimmy Fallon. I always get a cousin or someone calling and saying, "Oh my goodness, why didn't you tell me?" I'm like, "I have no idea." They don't tell us anything. I mean, I work for the developer division, so I think about developer tools. I think that Windows 7 coming out was just as exciting and wonderful as anybody else did. So,
mm-hmm. Yep. I was thinking it was very exciting myself. So it was funny. I was talking to somebody yesterday, and I said, even though I don't work on the Windows team, never have worked for Microsoft, whenever a new version of Windows comes out, I still feel kind of like I'm part of it in a way, because I have to write about every little twist and turn of Windows. I mean, I've been writing about Windows 7 for 3 years, so mm-hmm. It's like, wow, they did it. On to the next thing,
Yeah, I feel like you should get your little Ship-It badge or your piece of clear plastic that you put on your fireplace mantle. It says.
My non-blue badge.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I've worked at Microsoft now. It'll be 2 years in September, October, somewhere in there. And while I was in no way involved in shipping Windows 7, I did file some bugs. And I learned some really interesting things about how bugs work, is that if it's a non-interesting, and I put that in quotes, non-interesting bug, like one that's not a huge deal, then you really have to kind of be the advocate for that bug. Mm. So I think I filed maybe 10 or 15 bugs, and I got 6 or 7 fixed. And these are all kind of mostly aesthetic things, like, this icon is ambiguous, or, when you do this really obscure thing to the start menu on a Tuesday, then this happens. But when those bugs closed and you can like search in the bug database for Scott H.A. and you go, what did Scott H.A. file? I feel like, hey, yeah, I made this a better product. So I feel like if I ever hear that someone did that weird thing to the start menu on a Tuesday and it worked, that I had a tiny, tiny role in that. And that was a sense of pride I didn't think that I would get, because I'm trying not to be assimilated by the big blue monster.
Yeah, I mean, I have done nothing like that. I get to play with some of the test builds of Windows 7. Like, I got the beta and the RC. But, I'm not a techie. Even though I write about operating systems, I kind of write from a layperson's point of view. Mm-hmm. So, I still was interested in seeing how the whole process works and how that all happens and how bugs get fixed or don't. It's interesting.
Yeah, the triage process is really interesting. They put a lot of thought into what the end user experience is going to be. I found some really obscure bug when a certain printer was installed, when when a certain printer was plugged in, when you booted up, then your boot up would be slower. And it was some obscure firmware driver, and they had to think about, well, how many of these printers are out there and what'll happen? It's really interesting to me, because with like Apple products, you've got, a lot less hardware diversity. But with Windows, man, you don't know what anybody's running, Who knows what random TV, European TV card that they have plugged into some random mouse, and it all has to work together.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's it's always kind of funny to me when people just say, well, Apple's products work so much better together. And, like, why can't Microsoft do that? I'm like, well, if Microsoft owned the end-to-end process, they could too. But that's not how it works. And there's all these different parts that come from different places, software, hardware, drivers, this, that. I mean, there's a lot of things to mix and match and see if they all work.
Mm-hmm. Now, you you just said something interesting. You said that you've been writing about this from the point of view of a lay person. So, I mean, you're not a programmer. You're not but you know, would you think of yourself as a power user? Or would you think of yourself as kind of an average Joe user or Jolene user?
Oh, I think of myself as a completely average user. And as mm-hmm. other people who've tried to help me fix things would agree, I'm sure.
mm-hmm.
It's funny. I know about technology. I'm a journalist by training, and I've never taken a computer science class. And, you know, everything I've learned about operating systems, I've learned by writing and reporting about them. So, you know, just because I happen to do that job doesn't necessarily mean when people send me something, I go, okay, run such and such a script or do this. I'll be like, okay, I don't know how to do that. Sorry, you guys got to help me here. And mm-hmm. so I'm in no way a power user.
So you're experiencing it as you go. Like, were you running betas of Windows 7? Did you experience it and as a user and say, "Wow, this feels different," or "Darn, those drivers don't work"? Were you having this happen as it happened?
Well, you know, I run as my day-to-day work machine Windows XP on a ThinkPad, and that's what I've been running for the past 3 years, and I still run that now. The way I experienced Windows 7 was on a loaner machine, a loaner ThinkPad, where I had the different beta and RC builds installed there. So I get to kind of go back and forth between the two and try it out and see what was different. And I have to admit, when I got my first build of Windows 7, I was like, yikes, I don't know how to do this, because I haven't been using Vista. And mm-hmm. so it looked really different to me because I'm still using the old XP look and feel, and it felt like a big jump. But after I used it a few times, I'm like, no, it's way more intuitive than I thought it was, and it's not going to be a switch that people can't make. I mean, I feel like if I can do it, so can they.
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to our producer, Lawrence, before the show while we were waiting for you to call in, and he said, yeah, I hear the Windows 7 is out. What is it like? Is it got a lot of eye candy? And I was like, well, that's a really loaded question, eye candy. I mean, is it prettier? Sure. Is it prettier for no reason? No, I don't think that's the case.
No, I would say actually what I liked about Windows 7 was it doesn't have a lot of eye candy, and it's kind of a stripped-down, clean-looking interface. And that appeals to me because I've actually tried to use the Mac operating system a number of times, and I'm always ridiculed by Mac users for not wanting to switch over to it because supposedly it's so much more intuitive and more fun to use and a better interface. But I feel like as someone who's used Windows all the time I've used a computer, it's not that intuitive to switch from Windows to Mac. Mac to me is more eye candy.
Interesting. I know that I like the Mac animations. You know, the windows are always running away like genies and stuff, which I think is cool.
Yeah.
But and we have two Macs at the house here. I've got a Mac which is kind of like the kitchen recipe machine. It's a Mac Mini, and then we've got a Mac Pro. But you know, people will say I'm a Microsoft shill, but I just keep booting Windows 7 on the thing. I just say, well, you know, forget about it. I'll just boot Windows 7 because it's a fine little Windows 7 laptop.
Yep. Yep.
You know, one of the interesting things about Windows 7 that surprised me was that I'm running it here. I'm sitting in front of four monitors on a quad processor machine with, I think I've got either 8 or 12 gigs of RAM. I've actually got so much RAM, I've forgotten how much RAM I have. And next to me over here, I've got a tiny Dell Mini with a gig of RAM and a little tiny 16 gig hard drive. And it's the same operating system. It's working really well.
Yep.
Have you run it on big machines and small machines?
I haven't. I've only tried it on the ThinkPad. But, you know, when it comes out in October, I'm really, really interested in buying a copy of Windows 7 preloaded on a netbook. And the reason I am is because I'm probably like one of the stereotypical types who would make a lot of use out of a netbook. You know, I have a regular machine at home that's my laptop, everyday machine, mm-hmm. but I want a machine I can just grab, throw in my purse, and go cover a press conference. And my laptop right now is a little big and a little heavy to do that. So I'm like, wow, wouldn't that be cool to have a really good operating system on a netbook and just be able to take it and go and then come back home and use my regular desktop? So a little mix and match thing going on there.
Yeah, this talk of the Intel guys, the bosses at Intel, the suits, the executives saying that netbooks really aren't that useful seemed silly to me. I love my netbook. If it could get even a little bit smaller I wish it could have a fold out keyboard even. I mean, yeah. I was one of those guys who used to sit on an airplane with a Palm Pilot and a fold out keyboard. Remember those little keyboards that were like the size of a wallet and then you'd go, and it would suddenly be a full-size keyboard. You know, I'd sit there staring at this little black and white screen trying to write like the great American novel just because of the satisfaction I would get carrying an entire portable word processing system in my back pocket.
Yeah, I always feel like that too. It's funny because a lot of people say, oh, you don't really want a netbook. You want a full-fledged laptop. And I think there's kind of this disjointed understanding about who really does want a netbook. Like people are like, oh, it's only low power users, and they get really frustrated with the keyboard. They get really frustrated with not enough memory. But for somebody like me, like a quote information worker, as I'm called in the way Microsoft categorizes people, a lot of days I don't open a lot of apps. I might open like say Word and an email client and a browser, and that's it for the whole day. Like I don't use anything else. And so a netbook would be perfect for that.
Yeah, I'm looking at my taskbar here. I've got TweetDeck, I've got a browser, chat window, Zoom, and Outlook. So, I don't know, what is that, 6 applications?
Yep.
For some reason, the day of having 20, 40 different applications running at the same time, unless I'm actively developing, I don't find myself running 1,000 applications.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, if all you do is kind of what I do, which is create and consume information, you don't really need a lot of other apps. Like, people are like, what about Photoshop? I'm like, I've never used Photoshop in my life, you know?
Well, yeah, it's funny. I actually use, I use a program called Paint.net, which is a little free application. It's almost like what you used to need is built in now. So, you know, I used Photoshop back in the day, and then now I don't have to buy Photoshop because I'm not a professional designer. I'll use Paint.net, which is free. And then, you know, more and more, I'll just use the paintbrush that's built into Windows 7 because it'll save as PNG now, and it'll do the stuff that I need. So the expectation of what comes out of the box is greater. Yeah. Like I noticed that Windows 7, my DVD, remember the whole thing with Vista? I think you probably covered this. When DVDs wouldn't play out of the box, you had to go and get a codec or download something to make your DVDs play.
Yep. I remember that.
Now, even really complicated codecs on Windows 7 work out of the box. I didn't have to download any fancy, a codec, of course, for those folks that don't necessarily aren't native English speakers I think it's compressor, decompressor, and these are the files that allow you to watch various videos. And Windows Vista didn't have some codecs, I think, early on. And I seem to remember, maybe it was XP, that you had to download a DVD driver to get things working. But I'm realizing that I may want to go and pave my machine, you know, start from scratch with Windows 7, even though I'm running the release candidate. Back in the day, I used to have to install 50 to 100 different applications to get a machine back. I'm looking through my start menu here, and I could probably get a machine up and running in about 4 hours, and it would have taken me several days. Now, why don't you run Vista? You said you're running XP on your primary machine.
Yeah, you know, I run a really kind of low-end ThinkPad. I've only got a gig of RAM in this ThinkPad, and I never have upgraded it. Back to the, am I a power user? You know, so everybody's like, add more memory. And I'm like, yeah, I don't really think I know how. Everyone's like, oh, brother, you know, come on. So I've never really tinkered with it. And, you know, because I'm a one-person shop, I'm self-employed. I'm a freelancer who's self-employed. And I don't have an IT department. So I'm always afraid if I really screw up my machine, I'm really out of luck, because I don't have anybody who can go, okay, let me go back and, you know, check your archives and do this and that, and, oh, you did this or that to it, and that's why it's not working. I don't have somebody I can call on like that other than, you know, my friends who are in the tech community, and a few of them have said they'd make a house call, but, it's still, you know, kind of scary to somebody who's like an average user like me to be tinkering with all this stuff and moving to an operating system that I know has higher requirements than mm-hmm. possibly would be good on this PC. So I've just never done it.
And what kind of a ThinkPad is it? What's the brand, the model number?
X60. An X60.
Oh, yeah. You'll have no trouble with that on Windows 7.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm
not afraid to try it with Windows 7, but I was more afraid to try it with Vista Plus.
Oh, I see. Yeah, well, that's a very good reason.
Yeah. Also, you know, with Vista, I also got a chance to test that out as it was being developed, and I never liked a lot of things about it. You know, the hibernation lags and the kind of mm-hmm. All the UAC prompts, which they've scaled back quite a bit in Vista. I mean, in mm-hmm. Windows 7. So I kind of felt like I'm not really missing anything by not running Vista. I've got a fully patched XP machine, and I'm just going to stick with that until Windows 7 comes.
Right. Yeah, I'm trying to get my wife. I got in trouble early on in the Windows 7 cycle because I upgraded her machine to Windows 7 beta without asking.
Oops.
So I am no longer allowed to touch my wife's computer.
You're banned.
Yes, but yesterday when the release candidate came out, we RTM'd rather, released to manufacturing yesterday. So I'm like, I'm so excited. I get to introduce Windows 7 to my wife, and now there's a family pack, and I want to go get the family pack. And you know what you're getting for Christmas from me, I'm afraid, is a copy of Windows 7.
Well, that's not a bad gift, I don't think.
I don't think so. Do you think, now, you've done a lot of analysis and you've been watching all of this. I mean, is this a winner for us? Is this going to turn things around for Microsoft?
That's a big goal there, but it's definitely a winner. I think it's really great. I have to go with the analysts who say it's what Vista should have been. It's very solid, and it feels like, yeah, this is something you'd want to try and not be afraid to, you know, implement in multiple tens of thousands of seats across your company. You know, there's a lot of other things Microsoft has going on besides that, which make me scared to say it's going to turn all of Microsoft around. But I think it's really solid, and I think it was admirable that Microsoft did what they said they'd do. They got it in, to RTM within the window they said. Partners seem to really like it. I talked to Dell and some other OEMs, Toshiba, and they really think it's pretty solid and are committed to it. So those are all good signs.
That's good. Because you get a pretty wide, like you said, you work for yourself, so you're completely objective in this sense. So you contract to ZDNet. Is that how that works?
Yeah. I blog for ZDNet, and it's public information that the way we get paid by ZDNet is we get paid by our traffic. So every time you click on my blog, you are giving me a penny.
Okay, I didn't realize. That's actually a pretty good system, because it's always good to know who your journalists work for, to know if there's any special interests or whatever. So you don't care. I mean, I suppose you would care if Microsoft went away, because then you'd have to find another company to focus on. But
yes,
you're not invested in Microsoft one way or the other. You're just reporting on what's going on at Microsoft.
Right. We even have a pretty strict disclosure policy on ZDNet, where we have to say if we have any kind of stake in the company. So I own no Microsoft stock, so there's no reason I'm doing insider trading or trying to make the stock go up or down. And we have to be pretty clear about, you know, do we take gifts? Do we give them back? We're very strict about all those kind of things so that people don't think we're on the take.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't realize that. That's interesting. Okay. So you said you've been talking to the different Dell and the different OEMs, and it's looking like we're going to have machines in the stores that are going to have Windows 7 on them pretty soon, before October, middle of October.
Yeah, October 22nd is considered the day when retailers and the PC makers can start actually selling machines with Windows 7 preloaded. But people can get the bits before that. If you're like an MSDN or a TechNet subscriber, you'll be able to get them in August. And volume licensees can get them around September 1st. So, you know, people will start actually being able to get them before that big launch date.
Okay. I have to say, as a not just as an employee, because I've only been there 2 years, but as a person who's, you know, gone through the whole 95, 98, Windows Me, 2000, the whole process, I thought it was pretty awesome that we put it out on time.
Yeah. Yep. That was good. That was very good.
I'm watching people on Twitter. They're like, think it's a joke.
Yeah.
I thought a bunch of people thought it was a joke that we actually finished it on time.
Technically, it's early, as I'm sure people will point out.
Is it?
You know, for a long time, Microsoft was saying we're going to get it out by the first part of 2010. And a lot of us who covered the company were like, yeah, you're just giving yourself, you know, the maximum window, so you know you're going to be on time, if not early. But, you know, to get it out now and RTM this summer, it's good. They did it. So that's good.
Hey, everybody. This is Scott coming at you from another place in time. No doubt you probably bump into testing tasks now and then in your work. And, you know, writing functional tests is probably not your favorite thing. It's kind of difficult, takes time, and the results can be dubious. Well, get ready to start liking tests, thanks to Telerik, with the new WebEye testing framework. Building web automation tests is a breeze. You've got code automation with advanced ASP.NET Ajax and Silverlight applications. You can write a single test, have it executed against multiple browsers at once. You benefit from a rich API. There's link support, integration with Visual Studio unit testing, also NUnit, XUnit, and MBUnit. Not to mention the free wrappers for Telerik RAD controls for ASP.NET Ajax and Silverlight, all shipping with Telerik's new testing tool. One of the best features, the WebEye testing framework, which is developed by Art of Test, is it's absolutely free. If you've already got hooked on WebEye testing framework, start using it right away. Go to Telerik.com for more info. Thanks a lot. So if you, I want to get back onto one other thing, because the idea of you as a user of Windows and as a journalist watching Windows is interesting to me. You are, independent. You have an XP machine. You have a Windows 7 machine off to the side. You have no IT department to keep you, in line if you install some driver. So if your machine's down, then you're in trouble.
Yes.
Do you use Windows Home Server? Because I know you blog about Home Server also.
Here's another funny thing about my weird existence. So I live in New York City, and I live in Manhattan. I have a very small apartment, because everyone in New York does, unless you're very wealthy. Okay. And the home server guys at one point were like, you want to get a home server and hook up all your, you know, different PCs and have them all back up to the home server? I'm like, I have nowhere to put a home server, literally.
Because your apartment is too small.
I'm like, I all my closet space is full. I mean, I have two closets in my whole apartment, and they're full.
You realize you're giving our listeners quite the visualization. They're trying to figure out this place is filled with research to the gill. You've got, you know,
no
bookshelves.
For a home server.
Have you seen a home server? I'm looking at a home server. It's the size of a dictionary. Surely you can fit a dictionary in your apartment.
I, the other day, was shopping for a blender, and I didn't buy it because I don't have a place to put it.
Wow. You need to. It's a shame you can't invest in Microsoft stock.
Space is at an ultra premium here.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's because you don't invest in Microsoft stock.
Yes.
Then you would be rich. Yeah, I tell you, the Windows Home Server, man, that was the operating system. Until Windows 7, that was the operating system that had me so stoked. I actually, funny Windows Home Server story, when we moved into this house here in Oregon, I needed to get the yard done. And we hired the guy to come and put in the lawn and to do some landscaping. And I'm a real notoriously cheap individual. And I noticed that the guy had this laptop, and you know these guys when you've got, well, you probably don't because you don't have a lawn. When you have a guy come and do your yard, they might have a pickup truck and then a laptop. And the laptop is probably from the late 70s at some point. And it's been thrown into the, you know, he just picks it up and he throws it onto the bench seats in his pickup truck. And this thing was just beat to hell. I hadn't seen a laptop as well loved as this thing. And I said, wow, you do your entire business on that laptop? And he's like, oh yeah, man, that thing died. That's my entire business right there. And, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, let me see, mean time before failure of a hard drive is 5 years. And this guy's had this thing for 7. He's literally on borrowed time. You know, Murphy's law would indicate that the next day, my lawn guy is going to have his business collapse because of his little laptop. So I said, I'll trade you a Windows Home Server if you give me $1,000 off of my lawn. So I went out and to Best Buy and bought a Windows Home Server. I think it was like $500. And I took it over to his house and I set it up for him.
Wow.
And got his laptop backing up and his wife's machine, his kid's machine. Whole operation was like about, I don't know, 3 hours, 4 hours. And then about 4 months later, he had a crash and he had the stuff that he needed off of his home server. So, I cannot, whether you use Windows Home Server or something, you know, God, back up your stuff. Please, people.
You know, the other reason I never took their offer of trying out the home server was, realistically, I have one PC. I mean, I have all these loaner machines that I'm always giving back and trading in and getting a different loaner. But I mean, if what would I really back up to home server except for my one machine?
Well, so let me give you an example. I have effectively, well, I have seven machines, but I have one machine effectively. I have, you know, my primary machine. Mm-hmm. And it had a 160 gig hard drive. And I recently got an SSD, right? Mm-hmm. A solid state disk that was a 250 gig. So how do I play with my new SSD while still continuing to work? Well, my home server backs up an image of the entire PC, the entire PC's hard drive every single night at 2 a.m. It wakes up the laptop, backs it up, and then goes to sleep. So all I had to do was remove the old hard drive, which is sitting right here next to me, put the SSD in, boot off of a CD. It automatically connected to the Windows home server and said, oh, this is your ThinkPad. Do you want me to restore? I click restore. Even though I backed up a 160 and I restored it to a 250, I was up and running about 4 hours later, and I'd restored my machine completely, booted off of it, and now I'm on the same machine with double the size of a hard drive, and it's an SSD, so it's twice as fast. What I'm saying to you is that, let's say your single machine crashes tomorrow. How fast can you get back up? With a home server, you just buy a hard drive, and you restore from last night's backup, and you keep working.
Yep.
I'm saying, you take a blender out of the kitchen and make the room.
Take my dictionary out and trade it for a home server.
You don't need a thesaurus anymore, Mary Jo.
No, I do not.
It must be a book, something large.
I actually recently, speaking of gadgets and devices, bought a Kindle.
Because fantastic.
I was running out of room to get any more books, and I love to read. So I was like, wow, I gotta solve this problem because I have no more space for any more books. So I got a Kindle, and man, it's awesome. I love it.
Do you have the Kindle 2 or the Kindle DX?
Yep, I get the Kindle 2.
Okay. Now, I actually love my Kindle. I've talked about this on my blog a number of times, that the Kindle is a joy. Although I'm going to try to borrow a Kindle DX from somebody in town because I want to see what the larger one is like. Mm-hmm. Now, I get the New York Times on my Kindle. Have you set that up too?
No, I just read the Times on the web. So.
Oh, yeah, well, that's the same thing. The how many books do you have in your Kindle? And have you done the audiobooks?
You know, I really have never gotten into audiobooks. I really still like to read visually. So I got my Kindle in, I think it was around April or so, and I've read about 10 books on it so far, because I've noticed I can read way faster on the Kindle than I can paper. And it's just so handy because I travel a lot to be able to just take everything with you in this little tiny device. I get stopped everywhere I go in New York. People are like, is that a Kindle? Wow, cool. Can I hold it? I feel like I should get a commission on selling them.
You just said you read faster on a Kindle than a regular book. How is that possible?
I've noticed I am finishing books way faster. I think it's because I just keep a finger on the next page button, and my eyes just kind of go zing, 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 and next page. Next thing I know, I'm done with the book. So I don't know why.
That is interesting. I wonder if people are actually saving time, you know, crucial seconds that they didn't, they were wasting turning pages before.
I never thought it would really make that much of a difference. I'm like, oh, what's the difference between turning a page versus hitting a button? But, the type changes so quickly, and I think it's very easy on the eyes. I've been surprised how that's been, too. So I'm reading a lot and reading faster.
Yeah, I use my Kindle. I think that I'm reading faster or reading more. I don't know about reading faster, but I definitely know I'm reading more. I have the thing with me all the time. I read more magazines. And the thing that I feel really the worst about is kind of exactly the idea that this is a direct link from Jeff Bezos into my wallet. So it makes it so easy to give him money. We might as well just deduct it from my paycheck. But I feel bad because I'll be at the airport. I'll go to a bookstore that's owned by some poor, you know, businessman. I'll flip through the physical book and then I'll buy it on the Kindle while I'm standing there. So Jeff Bezos is actually stealing money from this man while I stand in his bookstore.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of like the same thing with music, you know, like how you used to be able to go to Virgin Records, which are all closed up in New York now, and you could, like, listen to a CD or listen to new music and then, like, go home and buy the digital version, you know? It's like, oh, I'm kind of stealing in a way because I'm using them to preview if I want something or not.
It is sad. Now, this is a jagged segue, but I wanted to make sure we talked about this before before I let you go. The Chrome OS, what do you think about this?
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about it. Number one, we don't know much about it, so it's kind of hard to, quote, think about it. We don't really know what it's going to look like. How much is it really an operating system versus a browser? How much is it Linux versus not? But I was reading a really interesting speculative piece by Michael Miller, you know, who used to be the editor-in-chief of PC Mag, about it. And he pointed out that, you know, Google never said this was a PC operating system. And, you know, everyone's saying it's going to compete with Windows and it's going to be another, you know, thorn in Microsoft's side. But what if he's right and it's not really a PC OS and it's just like a dedicated netbook OS? That's all it is. You know, it's, so is it really meant to go head-to-head with Windows, or is it just kind of a glitzier, souped-up browser? I think it's an interesting question, and I'm really curious to see what it looks like.
That is an interesting question. I think that there's kind of two sub-questions there. One is support for drivers, right? I mean, are they going to take Ubuntu and then strip it down and put Chrome browser on it? And then that would be a general-purpose PC OS, but maybe they would block it so you couldn't install anything, which is basically an appliance OS. And then the second question is, well, what about Ubuntu? I think that Ubuntu as a Linux desktop has such a following, and people who are into Linux enjoy it so much that they might find that it was presumptuous of Google to go and think that they could make their own. You know, to announce the Chrome OS might offend Linux users who already like their chosen operating system. But I think the really interesting question is, are they presuming a fundamental shift in the way that software is run? Like, who was it who said recently that they thought that the App Store was a bad idea?
Yeah, a few people have been saying that recently.
Yeah, they're saying, like, the death of the App Store, like, the App Store is a blip. The App Store we're talking about is the iPhone App Store. The idea that you would go to a store online, purchase software for a specific machine, and bring it down. It feels like Google and the folks that are betting on HTML5 are saying that this is a transitional period that we're in, and that all software will be written in HTML5. All purchase software will be, something that you'd buy a subscription to or you'd buy access to, but you'll end up running it in some kind of a browser. It was the Palm guys. That's who it was. It was the CEO of Palm, and their operating system on the Palm Pre is basically the entire OS is like a web browser.
Yep.
I don't know. I think I understand the point of view that really my netbook is a portable browser. But just when I think that, I need to run Excel, or, you know, just when I think that, I run Visual Studio. So.
Right. Exactly. Or you want to hook it up to a printer.
Exactly.
Like, that's the other thing. We don't know. Can it print? Can it work with any existing peripherals? Like, that kind of means it's not, to me, if it can't, is it an operating system, quote unquote, at all?
Yep. Yep. I have no idea.
Yeah. I'm going to be really curious to see what it looks like.
Now, when I chatted you earlier, you were asking about a thing called Gestalt.
Yes. I'm curious about Gestalt. I read about it on the Mix Online site, and I was chatting with Jeff Sandquist a little bit about it. And I'm trying to think of a way to explain it to a layperson, because it's supposedly meant to make developing easier. So I should be able to explain it to a non-programmer, right?
Okay. That's a good question.
So can you
help
me, Scott?
Yes, I can. So in the old days, we wrote HTML, and an HTML was a declaration of what things should look like. And you'd say, here's a table, here's a picture. Isn't that nice? And that was HTML, and it was good.
Yep.
Then JavaScript, which was originally called LiveScript and has nothing to do with Java, came along. And this let us take the description of what something should look like and add a description of behavior. I could write a tiny program in a tiny language, and it was also good. And then JavaScript grew up and became a full-fledged, powerful, object-oriented engine. And then the JavaScript wars began. And everyone wants faster and stronger and more wonderful. But all the while, there's a group of people who just don't like this language. They just don't find it to be the language that makes them happy. Everyone is speaking Spanish, and they want to speak Italian. They just don't like it. So what Gestalt is the opportunity to plug in different languages that make you as a developer happy. So from the point of view of the layperson, nothing changes. Web pages are fun and they look great. From the point of view of the developer, suddenly someone has said, it's okay to speak Italian. Don't worry. We'll speak English. You speak Spanish. We'll speak Italian. You can use Ruby. You can use Python, and you can talk to your web pages, and as well as JavaScript. It's just a choice. And the way it's done is with Silverlight, which is a plugin like Flash. Flash speaks one language, but Silverlight is a general system that can speak any language. So it's conceivable that other people could extend Gestalt and make other languages available, all of which just make developers happier.
So is Silverlight inside of Gestalt, or how does that work?
Okay. So Silverlight is a general runtime. It's a general engine that knows how to talk, it knows how to speak .NET. And while JavaScript engines know how to speak JavaScript, like, for example, Google Chrome and Firefox and IE all speak JavaScript. Like with IE, I can show you the file on your disk that says that's JavaScript. It's called jscript.dll. And I could point to it and say JavaScript lives there. Silverlight isn't a language. It's an environment. It's a runtime. It's a place for a language to run in. But it's not specific to any language. What Gestalt is doing is it's taking the language out of your HTML page, handing it to Silverlight and saying, hey, run this. And because we have things like Iron Ruby and Iron Python, now we can run Python and Ruby from the browser. So in this case, you wouldn't even need to see that Silverlight existed. You could make a tiny 1 pixel by 1 pixel sized or invisible even, Silverlight instance. You know, you think of Flash and you think of showing up at a web page and having Flash take over the screen.
Yep.
With something like this, it's a little bit more, subtle. The Silverlight may not even show itself. It may be invisible. But the developer is going to utilize that engine and say, oh, you've got Silverlight? Great. I want to speak Ruby and I'm going to hand it to you. Yeah. As I understand it from Jeff Sanquist's team, it's a lab. It's a thing that they've invented as an experiment to see if it's possible.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that everyone who's a programmer has thought about, but no one actually had the chutzpah to do it. And Jeff's team just decided, you know, people need to do this, so let's just try it and see what happens. It's really an interesting idea.
Yeah, it really is. I didn't realize the Silverlight connection, and that's kind of cool, too.
Yeah, so Silverlight is a generalized engine. So like an example would be, you know, so let's say you're a Ruby programmer and you're writing Ruby code, but you really wish you could write Ruby code in the browser. Then you could do that, too. Yeah.
Do you know anything about why the code name Gestalt?
I don't know. I haven't asked them. I'd have to ask Jeff Sanquist on Twitter. But isn't the Gestalt of something is the gist? It's the general general structure of something to get your point across.
Yep.
So I would think that
they're making a point.
Well, I would say that I think they are getting their point across. They're using a different language to do it. They could have called the thing Project Get Your Point Across. But that would use English, which is a language we're already using. So why not say it in German and say Project Gestalt?
True.
They got their point across of the different language,
which
is exactly what Gestalt does.
Yep. Very interesting. I have a question for you. Can I throw one out to you?
Okay. The interview is over. Yes, Mirjo.
No, this is an easy one. Because I've been asking a lot of people this who are using Windows 7, and the responses have been very mixed. What do you think of touch in Windows 7? Like, are you a big touch fan, touch on a laptop and touch on a PC? I mean, I understand why people like touch on a phone and why some might even want it on a Kindle, but what about on a laptop?
I was one of the tablet people early on. I definitely get that. The problem is that, you know, my phone is greasy. It's disgusting. And I sure don't want anyone touching my screen. I'm less interested in touch in the physicality of it and more interested in the gesture aspect of things. It's not the fact that I actually have to physically touch my screen to move that window. It's the fact that maybe in a couple of years, I won't have to touch the screen at all. I'm looking at three or four monitors in front of me here. Here's my browser at my right hand. I would like to just gesture, flipping my hand to the left, and I want that browser to kind of move over to the middle window, the middle monitor. That's the promise of touch for me, is not having to touch anymore.
Interesting.
So I don't think it's about touch. I think it's about gestures.
Yeah, that's cool. Because I'm not a big touch advocate. I never really liked the tablet. I just couldn't get used to that as much as I actually still take my notes by hand on paper because I can write faster than I can type even. But I'm always kind of puzzled over the touch thing because I'm like, wow, who wants to go and like be touching their laptop? I just don't see why you would want to do that when you've got the mouse. You get, you know, a lot of other ways. I mean, people say it's not meant to replace the mouse, but still, it feels weird to me. Like, I don't want to go touch my laptop.
Yeah, I think you have the right perspective. If you touch your laptop in the sense that if you're pretending that your finger is a mouse, your finger, like the finger as pointing device, I think is a mistake.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to click the minimize button with the tip of your finger faster than you can with a mouse. But if you could just make a gesture and just flip downward with your finger, I could see myself sitting on a plane with a machine, having, you know, one hand on the mouse, one hand on the keyboard, and maybe lift my hand up and just swipe downward to close a window or to minimize a window.
Yeah, so it'd be very handy in a small space like my apartment where my keyboard is kind of like mashed in on my little desk.
Do you have any elbow room at all? Are you able to lift your arms in your apartment?
You know, I used to live in Seattle, and I rented a four-bedroom house when I lived in Seattle, and now I live in one room, literally.
Wow.
Some people say this is progress. Some do not.
We need to have you rescued. We're going to send someone to your house, and we're going to have you lowered from the window because this is really concerning. Well, thanks so much, Mary Jo Foley, for talking to me today. And you can read Mary Jo's stuff up at All About Microsoft at blogs.zdnet.com/Microsoft. And you're on Twitter now, too, right?
Yes, I am. Mary Jo Foley on Twitter.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. That was fun. Thanks for having me on.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.